Welcome to another edition of the Spooky Scani podcast, the podcast that talks about everything spooky, paranormal, and weird in the state of Wisconsin. Since it's April, I thought that it would be remiss of me to not discuss the founder of Earth Day and the actual founding itself. And it was created by a Wisconsinite, naturally. His name was Gaylord Nelson, and he was born on June 4th, 1916, in a city called Clear Lake. It's located up in Polk County, which is kind of the upper northwestern corner of the state, and is about an hour away from Minneapolis. Nelson's father's parents, so his parental grandparents, were immigrants from Norway who moved to the area in 1878. And I couldn't find much about his maternal grandparents, but his mother was a nurse. At least she completed the training to do that, but she spent most of the time kind of at home, spending time with the kids, that kind of stuff. She taught Nelson a lot about the natural landscape and the world around him, while Nelson's father, who was a doctor and very politically active, taught him about political life. And this reminded me a lot, actually, of college in an interesting way. One of my history professors in college, who I love, we had a course on feminism in history, and we talked a lot about the two spheres of the world. In about the same time period, you had the domestic sphere, which was the realm of the woman who, you know, cleaned house and all of that. And then you had the public sphere, which was the realm of the man who did all of the outward things and voted and all that crap. So I thought this was a really clear-cut example of that, which was interesting. In the time period we're talking about, Clear Lake was not a great space to be in. There was a lot of pollution. There was a lot of poverty. Of course, we're talking leading up to the Great Depression, which was not great anywhere. But especially in kind of tiny towns and rural areas. The Great Depression, you know, brought a lot of itinerant workers to the area. A lot of people got grumpy about itinerant workers, and not only was there an uptick in just general assholery, there was a lot of racism, a lot of extra bigotry going on, and it's not exactly xenophobia, because that's not... it's not exactly what this is, but you have people coming in from other spaces that are not your own space. I guess, for lack of a better word, xenophobia is what was going on. A bunch of the county's farmers actually went on strike in 1933, and it forced the local creamery to close down, which I think was interesting. The Works Progress Administration launched a bunch of projects in the region to do things like build roads, take care of wetlands, build the town's first sewer system, you know, things like that. And Gaylord Nelson actually took a job shoveling stone on one of the crews right after graduating from high school in the mid-1930s. And not only was it a lot of hard work, he also really didn't like the fact that he contributed to disturbing and destroying a lot of really beautiful natural habitats in the area and ruining fresh water in the name of progress. And that kind of pushed him to go to college. He followed his older sisters to San Jose State University. I couldn't figure out for the life of me what his actual major was in. Some sites said economics, others said political science. I guess we don't know. I probably could have found out if I dug deeper. but I did not have time. It's okay. He really loved kind of exploring California and looking at all of the beautiful nature in the area, especially at the time period. And he would always come back home during the summers and worked in a cannery. He graduated in 1939, and in 1942, he also completed a Bachelor of Law degree at the UW Law School here in Madison, and was set to begin practicing law, but was quickly drafted into the Army. While there, he made first lieutenant, trained as a medical technician, commanded a segregated black company, and then spent the rest of the war in Okinawa, and actually met his future wife there, who was a nurse named Carrie Lee Dotson. I think it's really cute that his path, you know, like, I don't know how his father and mother met, but to have two medically minded people in a relationship and then be somewhat medically minded and wind up in a relationship with another person similar, I think it's kind of cute. I'm a nerd. When he came back from the war, the political landscape of Wisconsin was shifting a lot. The Republican Party, and when I'm talking about this right now, I'm not talking about the same Republican Party we see today. We're talking about the Republican Party of Lincoln era ideals. So think slightly more liberal than actual Republicans we think of today. So they had enjoyed almost an exclusive rule of the state of Wisconsin since before the Civil War. So really long standing. And, you know, there might be like rifts between groups in the party. There were some third parties that popped up, but nothing that really stuck around significantly. And during this time period, though, is when things did start to shift from Lincoln-era Republicans to Fox Newsy-era Republicans. Obviously, no TV yet, but that's kind of what was happening. And it was destroying the ideals of the party, shifting the party's platform, shifting who wanted to stay in the party. And this was not something specifically limited to the Republican Party at the time. It was kind of a everybody thing. I mean, think about it, with the war ending, with all of the things that had just gone on, there was a lot of isolationism, like, why the hell did we get in the war in the first place? It's not our business. And it's kind of the, funny enough, that's one of the things that at the time started help shifting political ideologies. It's not much different than today, right? Where we have people questioning, why are we getting involved in this conflict or that conflict? And not necessarily thinking about the general human rights of people everywhere. I don't know. That's a tangent. So during this time period, Philip and Robert La Follette, who are the sons of the legendary Progressive Firebrand, fighting Bob La Follette, and we'll talk about him eventually, they had led followers out of the Republican Party in 1934 and had suffered a lot of defeat and kind of came back in 46. And in that November, Bob the Younger lost his Senate seat, which really signaled the end of an era here in Wisconsin. And, you know, Gaylord Nelson was like, all right, I am going to try to bring this Republican progressivism to Clear Lake. I'm going to try to be in the state assembly. Let's do it. And he lost. At the time, though, he decided he was going to move back to Madison. So he did that, and he offered legal counsel to unions, spent time with a lot of friends from law school, really made some great connections, and then spent a lot of time talking with friends from law school and other spaces about rebranding the Democratic Party and about bringing that progressivism to this side. So what they really wanted to do was link people in Milwaukee who were, at the time very pro-union, you had a very large working class, and then you had a lot of progressives who were feeling the pain of the shifting ideology, connect them with people in Madison who were and still are very much seen as a base of intelligence, right? With the school here, with all of the educational opportunities, it's kind of the smart kid town. To put it bluntly, not that people in Milwaukee aren't smart, but it's kind of seen as a liberal safe haven. So to kind of link these two groups and see what they could do together, and see how much they could lift up people in rural areas and around the state. So in 1948, after what the Capital Times called a rip, snortin', hide, tearin' kind of campaign, oh my god, won a seat in the state Senate, and he really championed advancing civil rights and reforming the government, and really pushing progressive ideals that people had been thinking about when Bob La Follette was really popular, and making such big waves. He worked tirelessly throughout the state as the Democratic Party co-chair for Wisconsin. And thankfully, with all the work that he put in, he was able to shift the state's political leanings. Not single-handedly, mind you, but he played a major part through a large number of local and then statewide races through the 1950s. Things began to change and shift back to more progressive ideologies. And Democrats managed to replace Joe McCarthy, yes, the motherfucker who hunted down leftists, with William Proxmire in 1957. And that was a huge win, not only for the state, but nationally and internationally. We had scared off a lot of entertainers, a lot of writers and artists who were very, very, very left-leaning with the whole, like, red communist scare and McCarthy's, for lack of a better term, witch hunts. So it was really good to get him out. And maybe at some point, if I feel like torturing myself, I will do an episode on him. I'm going to have to do it. I know I am, but not soon. The following year, so 1958, Nelson ran a successful campaign to be the state's second Democratic governor of the century and the first governor ever from northern Wisconsin, which is pretty great. He served 4 years as governor, which was two-year terms. And throughout his reign in the early 1960s, he pushed for better care and better protections for the environment. He took what was at the time a very large set of departments and divisions and smushed them down into the Department of Resource Development, and established a youth conservation corps, which helped employ over 1,000 young people and created green jobs for them, where they were doing things to help preserve nature and really good things across the state. He also fought to earmark $50 million for the Outdoor Recreation Action Program, which, you know, bought up thousands of acres of land and converted them into public parks and wilderness areas. And those spaces serve not only as great spaces for families to visit and exist in, and, you know, free entertainment spaces, essentially, but they've also really helped preserve a lot of wildlife. So I live in Madison. You know, it's not necessarily, when you think of a college town, you don't think of deer walking down the road. You don't think of turkeys crossing the road in the middle of your morning commute. And those things happen, and they happen because we have the natural spaces that allow wildlife to thrive and live alongside humanity in a way that lots of places don't have because they didn't plan for it. And I think, to Nelson's credit, he really helped create a space where wildlife and humanity could live side by side and not necessarily butt heads a lot. Unless someone's running late for work, and then there's a lot of honking. The turkeys in our area, they kind of wander about a 2 mile about area between like the school and our side of like almost heading into Middleton, which is just a block over from us, and we'll see them walking down the sidewalk. They'll wait till they know it's safe to cross. Sometimes they'll stand in front of buses, and it's always the dudes. And they will get very puffy and show off all their fancy feathers. And I just imagine Joe Pesci, like, as the turkey's voice, like, what you gonna do? I'm gonna fuck you up. Like, I don't know. That is a super tangent, too. I am so sorry. Not really, though, because now you all envision what I envision every time I see the turkeys. Joe Pesci. Another one of the things that Nelson really worked towards was ending the kind of lobbying system as it was set up then for the state of Wisconsin. And if you're familiar with how lobbying works on the national level, and how many people who are pro-gun get a ton of money from, say, the NRA or other, you know, people who don't want to put so many restrictions on tobacco get money from cigarette companies, etc. I think it's a little better now than it was in the 90s, thanks to some laws that had passed, but it was bad. It was very bad, and that was something similar going on in the state level here in the 60s, like late 50s, early 60s. So he really switched that up. He put a lot of restrictions on lobbyists so that they couldn't do that. He just overall really consolidated the state government departments and made them work more efficiently. He really tried to champion, racial. Oh my God, I'm having brain fog and I cannot think of the word that I want to use. Racial equity. Jesus, I'm so sorry. Just as an aside, if you don't have chronic illnesses, brain fog is something that's like almost a cognitive delay. and you can't think of the right word, or you might say broccoli when you mean to say anti-disestablishmentarianism, like something that completely doesn't make sense. Anyway, so he really championed racial equity and putting an end to discrimination, specifically on the basis of race or religion. Those were his biggies. And he envisioned what he is quoted as talking about as the creation of a social structure founded on quality instead of quantity and moral might instead of military might. Which, having been through war, I'm sure came across really well too. Like, I've been through this. I helped treat people through this. It sucked. It was awful. Let's not do the military thing. In 1962, he was elected to the National Senate and served three consecutive terms, so he wound up serving from 1963 to 1981. And when he got there in 63, he basically immediately signed on as a co-sponsor of President Kennedy's Civil Rights Bill and participated in the March on Washington. He also convinced JFK to start a national speaking tour to discuss conservation and environmental issues. And as President Johnson came into power, he really, Nelson pushed for advanced civil rights legislation and ending poverty. He really, really wanted to fight that. And I'm sure growing up during the Great Depression, and in a city where people were very, very hard hit by that, pushed him to champion that cause. He really saw these things linked to his environmental agenda, right? Because it's not just about conserving natural resources. It's about using human resources well. It's about, you know, if we end poverty, there will be fewer excuses to do things that negatively impact the environment, because we'll be able to live at a baseline that allows us to make smarter decisions and do things that help protect the environment as opposed to negatively impacting it. In 1964, he wrote the following: "We cannot let a situation continue in which millions of our fellow citizens do not have a suitable environment in which to live and raise their families." So he proposed a slate of federally funded green jobs. He talked to officials around the country and, you know, talked a lot with President Johnson about how much, you know, labor was out there not being utilized, and how if we could create more jobs focused on environmentalism, we would not only help the environment, but create jobs that could help bring families out of the poverty cycle and lift them up. In 1965, he chided President Johnson for not doing enough to stop the lawlessness, terrorism, and economic coercion in the Jim Crow South perpetuated against civil rights activists. He worked to secure federal protections for activists as a part of the Civil Rights Act in 1968. He was an early and very passionate critic of the Vietnam War, and also really disliked the misappropriation of public funds that was happening during the time period, too. It became clear to him that spending so many public funds on even things like environmentalism was not going to actually fix things. We had DDT, a pesticide that was developed during this time period, and it was sprayed on lawns, like, here in the Madison area. And we watched as it began showing up in fish and groundwater all over the nation after it was used. You know, other synthetic chemicals and things like detergents, or as a result of mining practices and industrial production and pollution, you know, spread it throughout the water. You had smog all over because of no standards on car emissions, contaminants in food, large numbers of pharmaceuticals showing up in waterways because people would just flush them instead of, like, turning them into the police, which is probably how that system got started. And really, what he saw, and he talked about this in 1965, is that, quote, man cannot live or act apart from his environment. And really what he saw was, you know, we were being so wasteful, we were being so thoughtless and careless, and not necessarily always of our own accord, right? The average person isn't like, oh, nothing's gonna happen if I flush these down the toilet. Like, they've got a million other things going on, right? But how do we lift up through education? How do we lift up through talking about it, through public awareness, so that we know that those things aren't great to do, right? So he immediately called for sweeping government regulations, bans on pesticides like DDT, the end of the internal combustion engine, bans on dumping in waterways and oceans, and even had a constitutional amendment that guaranteed every person had the right to a decent environment, which I think is a fascinating idea. In July of 1967, there was a riot in Milwaukee that turned deadly. And I don't know the full story, so we'll probably explore that at some point. But he attributed this to thousands of citizens with inadequate educations, low incomes, poor housing, and poor job opportunities. As a soldier in Johnson's War on Poverty, he got more excited about that than the president did. He wanted to have a $10 billion with a B dollar program of public works projects and job training. And while Johnson was excited about that, he was like, I'll give you a tenth of what you asked for. And, you know, Nelson proposed a ton of projects and they really took off, including things like the National Teacher Corps, which trained new educators, particularly a high concentration of people of color, to then turn around and teach in impoverished schools. And kids began seeing themselves in their teachers. And I think that is incredibly amazing. During his 1968 re-election campaign, Nelson was praised by Vince Lombardi, the general manager and former coach of the Green Bay Packers, as the nation's number one conservationist at a banquet in Oshkosh. And Oshkosh is about an hour southwest of Green Bay, or 25 minutes south of Appleton, if you know where those places are. Nelson decided, well, his campaign, I don't know who exactly made the decision, to turn that banquet speech into a radio and television campaign commercial, and pissed Lombardi off because Lombardi was, like, he and his wife were very Republican. And the Republican Party was pissed too. So it did not make him friends with the Lombardis. Let's just say that. In 1970, Nelson called for congressional hearings on the safety of combined oral contraceptive pills, which were famously called the Nelson Pill Hearings. And as a result of the work that he did, side effect disclosure in patient inserts were required for the bill, which was the first disclosure for a pharmaceutical drug. I'm going to say it again. that was the first disclosure of side effects for a prescribed drug that got to patients. Holy shit. Like, I take a bunch of medications. Okay, like, I am alive because of them. Literally, or inflammation in my body would probably have killed me by now. And the fact that I could potentially not have known about a side effect by being born just a couple decades earlier. Holy shit. And to not know which side effects are coming from which medications, or side effects are even possible from some medications. Like, Earth Day's great, and we'll get into it. But this is what makes Nelson cool, in my mind. He made it so that patients knew what we were getting ourselves into. And that is badass. Anyway, to Earth Day. Earth Day began as a teach-in about environmental issues. And Nelson wanted to propose a day where everyone around the nation could host like a teach-in. You know, teachers could teach it to students, and people could talk about it in libraries or at universities and elsewhere, right? To really talk about environmental problems and what can we do to fix them. And immediately it took off. National media like picked it up and ran with it. And his office got flooded by letters of support. So he turned around and he created a very small national office that was there to help offer support to people around the nation that were going through and creating grassroots efforts to educate and to enact change. He didn't like the idea of something like a top-down organization because it never works out the way you want it to. Instead, he later reflected, Earth Day planned itself. An estimated 20 million Americans gathered on April 22nd, 1970 to talk about the ecological troubles going on in their cities, going on in larger spaces, and not only to demand action from each other and to plan direct action, but also to demand action and accountability from their elected officials. And that's important. It really kicked off the environmental decade, right? We think of the 70s, we think of like hippies and, oh, all these people who want to like not go to war and like not destroy the environment. It's so weird. With all that Nelson did in the 60s, he tried to pass so many things. He tried to get so many things moving. And now he was involved in so much. So not only did he create Earth Day, right? He's also involved in Clean Water Act, the National Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, the Federal Pesticides Act, the Clean Air Act, the Environmental Education Act, the National Hiking Trails and National Scenic Trails Act, and the establishment of the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. That lakeshore and where the Apostle Islands are, it's about 2 hours east of Duluth, Minnesota, or like 6 hours north of Madison. And it's beautiful. The water's gorgeous. I have not been myself, but I look at pictures and I go, I need to go to there. And it's just a gorgeous space. And to be able to preserve that so that it's there for everyone to visit and enjoy is pretty great. He was also actually a pretty big advocate of small businesses, which I think is cool. He was a chairman of the Senate Small Business Committee and led efforts to authorize the first modern White House correspondence on small business, created the system of small business development centers at universities, and really improved the way that federal agencies handle small business and other entities through what's called the Regulatory Flexibility Act. I'm not going to talk about it. It's like over my head. But he did the thing. In 1973, he was one of three senators who opposed the nomination of Gerald Ford to be vice president. The other two were Thomas Eagleton and William Hathaway. I couldn't figure out why, but I also didn't really look that hard into it, so, After Nelson's 1980 defeat for re-election, he became counselor for the Wilderness Society in January of 1981. In September of 1995, in recognition of all of his work for the environment, he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He viewed the stabilization of the nation's population as an important aspect of environmentalism. And these are his words. "The bigger the population gets, the more serious the problems become. We have to address the population issue. The United Nations, with the U.S. supporting it, took the position in Cairo in 1994 that every country was responsible for stabilizing its own population. It can be done. But in this country, it's phony to say, I'm for the environment, but not for limiting immigration." We're going to get into that. Trust me. He also rejected the suggestion that economic development should be more important than environmental protection because, as he said, the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment, not the other way around. At the end of the Cold War, he called for the U.S. and Russia to allocate resources to working on environmental issues. He lobbied friends in Congress to stand up to the vintage McCarthyism of the executive branch after the September 11th terrorist attacks, which I think is cool. In the 1990s, he really did get into this overpopulation idea. It's bad. We're going to go into it in just a second. I just want to, like, get to where he dies first. And then we're going to go back into this. So, yeah, he received numerous awards, including two for the United Nations Environment Program. He gave a speech about Earth Day in 1995. Where he said some of the following. "All economic activity is dependent upon the environment with its underlying resource base. When the environment is fully forced to file Chapter 11 because its resource base has been polluted, degraded, dissipated, irretrievably compromised, then the economy goes down into bankruptcy with it because the economy is just a subset within the ecological system." Which, yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me. "We're dealing with a social, ecological, and economic challenge unlike any other in our history. It is a challenge that begs for the kind of dedicated, inspirational leadership provided by Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill in their pursuit of victory in the Second World War. This challenge is far more serious than the military threat to the Democratic West in World War..." It just says N. In World Wars? I don't know. "Nations can recover from lost wars, witness Germany and Japan, but there's no recovery from a destroyed ecosystem." Which again, like, yeah, that makes sense. In 2002, he appeared on the show To Tell the Truth as a contestant. And then he died of cardiovascular failure at age 89 on July 3rd, 2005. There's a bunch of places around the state named after him, including the Gaylord Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. It's also just called the Nelson Institute here at UW-Madison. So now let's get into this overpopulation bullshit. So, it's not great. It is not great, fam. So in the 1990s is when he starts championing this. There's this guy named Paul Ehrlich, who is the author of a classic book in environmental studies called The Population Bomb, and he served as an Earth Day advisor to Gaylord Nelson. And one of the things that Nelson wanted to push for, I think partially because of Ehrlich, was for better family planning services. And it wasn't because, well, let's make sure people are ready to have kids. Let's make sure, you know, people's choices as human beings are respected. It was because of concerns about overpopulation. He pushed the U.S. to shrink immigration quotas and help other nations establish their own population controls. And, you know, people really push back because it's dismissive of things that immigrants and people who go through asylum, like apply for asylum, go through. It doesn't take into account disparities in various parts of the world. So the crux of the matter is that ideas about overpopulation are often rooted in racism, classism, ableism, and of course the cis heteronormative white patriarchy. Often people who are harmed by these policies are not white. They are not middle to upper class. They are not abled. And often they're also not cisgender or heterosexual or men. And I think we have to sit with that thought, right? Sure, more people might live in different parts of the state, in the different parts of the country. More people tend to move to cities because those are where the jobs are. That doesn't mean that we set, whether at the city, state, or national level, limits on how many people can live here. If we go back to the idea of America being like every person for themselves and the American dream and pursuit of happiness bullshit, which is never actually accurate, any of those limits would put a huge damper on all of that. And those ideas don't mesh. In a 2017 article for Vox, David Roberts dives deeper. This is going to be a huge chunk of a quote. I will go back to calling him Roberts in a minute when I'm done with the quote. And that'll be your signal that the quote is over. Yeah. In practice, where you find concern over a population, you very often find racism, xenophobia, or eugenics lurking in the wings. It's almost always ahem, particular populations that need reducing. History is replete with examples, but perhaps the most germane recent episode was less than 20 years ago, as the Sierra Club, which was riven by divisions over immigration. A group of grassroots members, with some help from powerful funders, attempted to take over the national organization. These members advocated sharply restricting immigration, saying the U.S. should be reducing rather than increasing its population. Their contention is that the country's open immigration policies are hurting the environment by bringing in poor immigrants and making them richer, thus increasing their environmental impact. Of course, they swore up and down that xenophobia had nothing to do with it. I don't doubt that it's possible to be concerned about the environmental stress this population brings without any racism or xenophobia. I've met many people who fit that description, and they were well-meaning, if quite mistaken. Oh, God. And there were well-meaning, if quite mistaken, population-focused groups in the 70s and 80s. But in terms of public discussion and advocacy, anyone explicitly expressing that concern starts out behind the eight ball. The mere mention of population raises all sorts of ugly historical associations. Roberts is not wrong here. At all. I think he's just leaving out pieces that maybe 2 years later we understand better. Or maybe it's because I'm disabled, queer, and trans. I don't know. But we're not talking about the ableism. We're not talking about that the U.S. already places heavy restrictions on the number of disabled people that can come over because of, like, what a strain on our resources they would be. And let's not pretend that countries like Canada are any better. All the people after the 2016 presidential election telling me I should move to Canada. Guess what? Canada won't have me because I will place too much of a burden on their healthcare system. First world countries already put these kinds of restrictions in place. And we're supposed to think that, like, making those restrictions broader and even more awful is going to help. All that's going to do is lead to population decrease because people are dying. And I don't know about y'all. I don't want that fucking shit on my conscience. I almost said conference. Again, brain fog. And the way the Roberts talks about this in the article, it's not a bad article. I definitely suggest reading it. But do keep in mind it's from a very cis heteronormative lens, aka there's binary gendered language, and it's under the assumption that, like, parents who do the sex are going to have the kids because one does the eggs and one does the sperm, and that's not reality. So read that. I've put a link to it in the show notes. I put a link to a couple of other pieces that are along a similar nature. There's a piece from The Guardian that discusses two sides of the issue, including, like, how beneficial large cities are, how they can be, like, technological idea-producing cities. Like San Francisco. That was phrased terribly. I'm sorry. But yeah, like, cities tend to push technology further, and it's, like, not only because of necessity, but also, like, it just serves as an incubator. I don't know. Green living tends to excel in cities, too, because you've got people, like, in San Francisco that are doing composting. They have citywide composting. Madison just did composting for a while. It wasn't well, like, put out there. I had no idea until they stopped the program. You've got a bunch of people living in apartments and they have nowhere to do their compost. Like, I don't know. For a city so rooted in environmental action, not great. Anyway, you know, it seems to me that the people who are against overpopulation are also against ways we might fight against that. You know, like, not ones rooted in white supremacist bullshit. If the concern was about actual quality of life or the environment, right, we would focus not on population density or overpopulation. Instead, we'd put our energy into lifting up the quality of life of everyone, especially those living in large cities. We would focus on improving access to things like family planning, comprehensive sex ed, contraception. We would improve equality between the many genders, including pay, and destroy legislation that allows not only different genders but disabled folks to be paid cents on the dollar. We'd improve adoption rates. We'd work better to, like, provide foster families with the resources and tools they need. We'd promote and accept families created in any form instead of telling queer families they can adopt more kids. We'd also stop approving and putting out articles tearing down millennials like me who aren't going to have kids. But then again, I'm American and white. So my kids are the ones that they'd probably want to have around until they learn that I'm disabled. And that's what I gotta say about that. It's always good to end the episode on a great diatribe. Ah, yeah. Please. If you are listening on Stitcher or Apple Podcasts or another program that allows you to rate, please do it. It helps people find the podcast. It makes me feel good and lets me put out cool things at work that say, hey, people should listen to my podcast because other people like it. Yes, I'm a nerd. I just started a full-time job and I told people about the podcast. People are already excited about the prospect of listening to it. They probably will have forgotten the name of it, which I'm okay with. But it's exciting to be able to talk more about it as, like, something cool instead of, like, oh yeah, I got this thing. Mumble, mumble, mumble. Anyway, please, again, if you have the ability to subscribe, Stitcher lets you do that. Well, like every podcast app lets you subscribe, I guess. But subscribe. Rate. Tell me what you think is going good. Tell me what you think is going bad. Tell me if you think I should edit more than I do. Which is not very much. I do not edit much. Yeah. Give me your thoughts. Send me emails. Send me Facebook messages. Let's tweet at each other. Let's be friends. I'd love to hear from people. I'd love to hear what people think is working, not working, what they'd like to see, all that stuff. But for now, I have a date with some tacos. And I hope soon you also have tacos. You just listened to the Spooky Scotty podcast. It's produced every 2 weeks by me, Kirsten Schultz. The intro outro music is from Purple Plant. You can find show notes and more over at spookyscotty.podbean.com, including a transcript in case you missed anything. Take a minute and rate and subscribe if you can. You'll help more people see the show by rating, and you won't miss a single episode if you subscribe. And that's pretty dope. You can support the show over at patreon.com/spookyscottypodcast, and you can email me anything you'd like me to know at spookyscottypodcast@gmail.com. In the meantime, sleep tight and don't let the badgers bite.